Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks, and we have one major story this hour because shortly before we came on air, we started getting the first reports out of Israel that the Israeli military is looking into whether it has killed the leader of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, the leader who has been in Gaza and is widely seen as the architect of those October the 7th attacks in Israel, October the 7th last year, which killed 1,200 Israelis and sparked this war that is continuing to this day. More than 42,000 Palestinians reported to be dead in Gaza, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. It is potentially a very significant development. Wira Davis is our correspondent in Jerusalem. Wira, what are you hearing from Israeli media and Israeli sources?
Well, yeah, let's differentiate between the two because there's some contradictory reports in the Israeli media. Some elements of the Israeli media perhaps have jumped the gun a little bit and said that Sinwar is definitely dead. We don't know that for sure. There's been no official announcement from the Israeli military or from the Prime Minister's office. What we do know is that somebody resembling Yahya Sinwar, physically anyway, has been killed, because there are some very graphic pictures online showing somebody resembling him in what is clearly the aftermath of a violent incident, either an airstrike or heavy military activity. Now, the Israeli military is saying that it's believed it's killed Yahya Sinwar along with two other Hamas operatives, and this may have been in a accidental encounter in southern Gaza. This is separate from another incident in the north, which we've been referring to later today, in which several civilians as well as Hamas operatives may have been killed. This is something completely different, sort of came out of the blue, but it does appear that Mr. Sinwar may have been killed. Now, of course, he's a he's basically Hamas's leader now, but he's also credited, of course, with organising and planning the 7th of October attacks last year. So this would be a huge military victory for Israel if indeed was Mr. Sinwar. We don't know that for sure just yet.
And I know I've heard you say on air, Wira, that, I mean, one of the odd things, were it to be confirmed as being Sinwar, is that it had been assumed that as part of his protection, he would be surrounded by Israeli hostages, because that would mean that the Israeli military would be cautious about engaging him in a firefight or calling in an airstrike. That doesn't seem to have been the case.
No, which is, again, one reason why we need to exercise caution now until we know it's definitely him. Forensic tests are being carried out, we understand, on the body as we speak. So at some point we will find out if it is Mr. Sinwar, but you're quite right. The Israelis had always accused him of using this ring of hostages as a sort of human shield to give him that layer of protection to perhaps prevent the Israelis hitting where they thought he might be in a big airstrike, because obviously that might kill Israeli hostages as well. And as far as the IDF is saying, there were no hostages found in the building where this body was found, along with two other suspected Hamas fighters. So another reason to exercise caution, because there are, of course, about 101 hostages still in Gaza. About two-thirds of those are thought to be still alive. So, again, it would be assumed that wherever Sinwar went in that vast tunnel network under Gaza, there would be hostages as well.
Yahya Sinwar, I mean, whether he is dead or does remain alive, I mean, it is worth underlining, Wira, just what a big figure he is, though, to Hamas.
Yeah, look, he'd spent 20 years in Israeli jails. He was released in 2011 as part of the deal to release the Israeli captive Gilad Shalit. But he was really known as a very hardline figure. And whenever somebody else in the movement, perhaps in exile, was perhaps favouring some sort of diplomacy with Israel, he was always said to be pushing things back the other way. He always favoured armed confrontation with the Israelis. And in that sense, he was credited with what happened on October the 7th. So when Hamas's leadership position became available with the recent assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, a lot of people in Hamas said, you know, Sinwar should naturally become the next leader of the organisation precisely because of what he had done on October the 7th last year.
Wira, I just want to keep you on the line, if I may, because it is worth reflecting. You mentioned it a little bit earlier about the continuing violence elsewhere in the Gaza Strip. These reports of an Israeli airstrike on a school in the Jabalia area of northern Gaza, reports from Palestinian officials that at least 22 people have been killed. The BBC has heard from Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, who sent us this voice note from the nearby Kamal Adwan Hospital.
I am Dr. Hussam Abu Safia. I am a director of Kamal Adwan Hospital. A few minutes before, we received a lot of patients injured due to the Israel target school named Abu Hussein. And unfortunately, all who present to our ER, children and women, to about 25 was killed and over 75 was injured. And our hospital is small in size. We cannot receive all these injured people. Most of people who present to us, women and children. We working actually under distress, under fear, under sound of the explosions everywhere, and we have a big challenge in our hospital. We have a lack of medicine, a lack of medical supply, a lack of medical equipment, and a lack of medical staff.
Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, who sent that voice note to our colleagues in the BBC Jerusalem Bureau, which is where our correspondent Wira Davis is speaking to me from. And Wira, I guess the point is that there has been, whatever the fate of Sinwar is, the suffering for huge numbers of Palestinians caught up unwittingly in this war carries on.
Indeed. And look, the death of Sinwar, if indeed he has been killed, does not necessarily mean all of that violence and death is going to come to an end. There's an ongoing Israeli military operation, a very intense military operation in northern Gaza. You know, all of Israel's allies, the British, the Americans, other countries that United Nations have urged Israel to perhaps think about the humanitarian consequences of what it's doing. But, you know, the incident we've just heard about there at the Abu Hassan school, Israel may well have been going after Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad operatives. But also there is, you know, to use that horrible term, collateral damage as well. And far too many civilians have been caught up in this. There have been several incidents since this operation began just over a week ago in which civilians who are trapped in effect or in parts of northern Gaza are being caught up in this very, very intense Israeli military operation.
Wira Davis, correspondent in Jerusalem, thank you very much for joining us. And indeed, on what Wira was saying, yeah, the Israeli army has named dozens of people it described as terrorists who were at the meeting at that school that they targeted. And they insisted that steps were taken to mitigate the risk of harming civilians. Dana Stroll was, until the beginning of this year, the US Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. She's currently Director of Research and a Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. If it is indeed confirmed that the Israel Defense Forces have killed Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, How significant would it be?
Absolutely, more than significant. It would be a game changer. The Israel Defense Forces identified three top Hamas leaders in Gaza right after October 7th that they sought to eliminate. Two of those three, Mohammed Daif and Marwan Issa, they have already confirmed to have eliminated, and this would be number three, together with Ismail Haniyeh, who was taken out in Tehran only a few months ago. It's a significant decimation of Hamas's top leaders.
Yeah, I mean, it does not necessarily, though, spell the end of the war.
It doesn't. First of all, there's still no answer to how to secure the release of the remaining hostages held by Hamas. It doesn't answer the question of what a post-Hamas Palestinian civilian administration looks like in Gaza. And it doesn't answer the question about what the remaining Hamas fighters on the ground in Gaza will do. But it would certainly have tectonic impact on the organization's command and control, organizational structure.
Sure. And I mean, clearly we have to carpet these this conversation with the caveats, which I know you would sign up to, that, you know, there has been no confirmation from the IDF, although I noticed that security officials on Israeli army radio are saying that they, in quotes, assess with high probability that it is indeed Sinwa. One impact I guess that some people might want to raise is whether it would change the calculations as far as Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, is concerned. Whether, were Sinwa to be killed, he could say, in a sense, mission completed.
I certainly think this provides Prime Minister Netanyahu the opportunity to do that. What his governing coalition has articulated was to militarily dismantle Hamas so that it could never again perpetrate an attack like what happened on October 7th, and to prevent Hamas from returning to exerting its own form of governance on the Gaza Strip. And both of those would be more of a possibility should Sinwar's death be confirmed later today.
And can I ask you about the other big story that we do know about this week, which has been confirmed, which is this letter from Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, and Mr. Austin, the Secretary of Defense, to their Israeli counterparts, saying that they are demanding that Israel do more to get aid in a consistent fashion into northern Gaza over the next 30 days. Or there may be severe consequences, and the U.S. ambassador to the UN warning Israel about what she called a policy of starvation in northern Gaza. How significant do you think that is?
I think it's very significant, and this is the next chapter in what has been an ongoing area of tension and disagreement between the Biden administration and the Netanyahu government since as early as October 8th, which is that there has been support for Israel's right to defend itself from Hamas's terrorism. There is no excuse for denying or preventing the delivery of humanitarian aid to Palestinian civilians in Gaza. So earlier this year, the Biden administration had certified to Congress that Israel was not blocking humanitarian aid and, in fact, facilitating it. And what we're seeing now is increasing concern.
Okay.
What's important about this letter is
just
that it
reminds... Just very briefly, if you would, yeah.
There are restrictions in U.S. law that we cannot continue to provide military aid should a partner be preventing delivery of humanitarian aid.
And that was Dana Stroll, the former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East, speaking to us from Washington. Through the program, we'll be reflecting on these reports out of Israel that the IDF is checking as to whether it has indeed killed Yahya Sinwar. We'll be getting updates through the program and analysis. But there's more about it as well online on our website, bbc.com/news. There is a live page now on those reports. This is NewsHour. And also coming up on the programme, as the British King heads to Australia for his 17th visit, but his first as monarch, we'll hear how the country remains split on whether it wants to become a republic.
When the King comes to Australia, people aren't going to line the streets waving Union Jacks. They're going to be waving the Australian flag because It's important to note that the King is just as much the King of Australia as he is the King of England.
That last little step of independence for us is splitting away from the monarchy. Having an Australian, somebody who lives here, somebody who represents us, someone who is able to go and attend events, not every 10 years, but every week.
That report from Sydney coming up in just over 10 minutes. Our headline this hour: Israel says it may have killed Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas and the architect of the October the 7th attacks. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks, and we're just going to step away from that major breaking story about Israel checking whether it has indeed killed Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas in Gaza, to look at a couple of other stories this hour. The Italian Senate has approved legislation which bans couples from seeking surrogacy abroad. The practice is already illegal inside Italy. The bill was driven through by the Brothers of Italy party, the far-right party of Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, who was elected on a manifesto of, among other things, what are broadly called traditional family values. Dominica Spinelli is a senator with Giorgia Meloni's Brothers of Italy party and a supporter of the bill.
This law for us is very important because the real challenge is to protection the minor and to protection the women. For us, it's important to stop the procreative tourism because in Italy, the rent-a-ring uterus is a crime, but it was not a crime for the Italian that went to another state and came back to Italy with a children.
Renting a uterus, as you put it. I mean, you say that this is to protect women and it's to protect children. Carolina Varchi introduced this legislation. She wrote earlier this summer that the purpose of the legislation was to work against what she described as LGBT ideology. Isn't that the truth?
No, this is not true.
Well, this is what she said.
No, Carolina Varchi, no.
She wrote on Facebook that her party, with this surrogacy bill, her party was working against LGBT ideology, as she put it.
No, this is not. This is a law to protect children. And yesterday in Senate, we have not spoken about LGBT feminists.
Okay, but to be clear, I mean, lots of people in Italy who have said that they support this have said that they are against the idea of gay couples having children.
This is not true. This is not true.
You don't have a problem.
This is not true because the Italian ordinament has all rights for children.
Tell me how this is going to work, because it's going to be difficult, isn't it, to prosecute people for doing something in another country where it is perfectly legal to do what they are doing.
This law is a law that has the great challenge to stop the tourism, the procreative tourism. So in Italy, the renting uterus is a crime, is a penal crime. Also, if an Italian goes to another state and come back in Italy, this is a crime.
You say it's against the exploitation of women. What about, I mean, some women offer surrogacy services without being paid. So presumably they're doing so willingly, but you're saying that is still a crime. So can you explain to me why that is exploitation?
This is also for us a crime with this law. This practice in the states where it's possible is a practice that has a contract. The contract has also money. We are not agree with this contract. There are many, many questions, many, many problems, many critics. I think that only women that are in critical condition are the object of this contract. The protection of these two categories, women and children, this is the real objective of this law.
And that was Domenica Spinelli, a senator with the Brothers, the governing Brothers of Italy party, speaking to me from Rome. One of the biggest pop stars of recent years, the singer Liam Payne, has died in Argentina. He was 31 and a former member of the hugely successful group One Direction. Baby, you light up my world like nobody else. The way that you lift your head gets me overwhelmed. But when you smile at the ground, it ain't hard to tell. You don't know, you don't know you're beautiful. You don't know you're beautiful by One Direction with Liam Payne singing. He fell from the balcony of the hotel where he was staying in the capital of Argentina, Buenos Aires. Our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson, interviewed Liam Payne many times over the years.
I was at the last ever One Direction show in Sheffield, and I think it is important to emphasise just what a global phenomenon they were. Their final tour in 2015 was the second biggest in the world that year. They played in Africa, they played in the Philippines, they went right around in the US. They were the first band in history to go straight into the albums charts with their first three albums and then repeated it with their fourth. That is the global scale of One Direction.
And it was obviously an extraordinary story as well as to sort of how they came together and how they became this phenomenon.
It was on a British reality TV show, The X Factor, and Liam Payne had actually auditioned for it in 2008 when he was only 14. And at the time, Simon Cowell, the boss, said, "You've got something, but you're too young. Come back in 2 years." And that's what he did. And that was the year that One Direction were formed on the show. When you look back, it's quite amazing to think they didn't even win the thing. They came third.
But then the frenzy began. And I mean, they must have been catapulted into a very, very strange life. I mean, really, as children.
I once interviewed them at the height of their fame and asked them the question, in the last year, how many nights have you slept in your own bed? And they all went, oh, as if they've never been asked before. And they counted and they went, we reckon 20. To do that when you are so young. Liam Payne was 16 when he started out. These guys were not seeing their parents for months on end. And when he left the band, after all that fame, all those millions of pounds he'd earned, he was only 22 years old. And he has spoken a lot since then about his mental health problems, about how when he was in the band, they wouldn't let them out of the hotel room. So what's in a hotel room? A minibar. And that led to him drinking.
And I mean, obviously, we are waiting to hear about exactly the circumstances surrounding his death. But from what we understand from police in Buenos Aires, they said they were called to reports of an aggressive man under the effects of drugs and alcohol. I mean, it's such a difficult story, isn't it? Somebody who's won fame at such a young age,
it's
but he struggled.
Really sad story. Even in the last week, one of his former girlfriends has issued a cease and desist letter against him. So he was dealing with that at the time. But the police have said that they found his body after emergency crews were called to respond to what had happened at the hotel. In the last few minutes, we've just had a statement from his family who say, "We are heartbroken. Liam will live forever in our hearts. We will remember him for his kind, funny, brave, as a brave soul. We are supporting each other the best we can as a family and ask for privacy and space at this awful time."
And One Direction, it sort of flared in enormous popularity at the time, became this phenomenon, as you say, but it has had enduring appeal, hasn't it?
Oh yeah, there's still new generations discovering them, but for a certain generation, they were their band. And many of those people are only about the age that he is now, and this is possibly the first time in their life they've ever had to deal with grief, and I think that is part of the reason we are seeing just such an enormous outpouring from the One Direction fans today, because they are still pretty young.
Colin Patterson, our entertainment correspondent on the death of Liam Payne. Much more to come here on NewsHour on those reports out of Israel that the IDF may have killed the Hamas leader, Yahya Sinwar. Stay with us if you can. Welcome back to NewsHour. We'll be heading to the Middle East very shortly. But King Charles III and Queen Camilla are on their way to Australia for the biggest overseas trip since the King began cancer treatment in February. A YouGov poll last year found a third of people thought the monarchy was good for the country, while one in five thought it was bad. There was talk of holding a vote to remove the King as Australia's head of state, but that's off the table for now. So just how enthusiastic are locals for this royal tour? Our correspondent in Sydney is Katie Watson.
With a night of bottomless drinks, a three-course dinner and an auction packed with royal memorabilia, the University of Queensland Monarchist League's annual ball was a sellout. The evening kicked off with a rendition of God Save the King, followed by Australia's national anthem. There was great excitement about what will be King Charles's 16th official visit down under. It's no mean feat to travel 10,000 miles and across 10 different time zones, all the while going through cancer treatment. That, say these students, speaks volumes about his fondness for this country.
Really excited. I think he's such a big part of our history and our tradition. It's really wonderful that we get to celebrate it.
When the King comes to Australia, people aren't going to line the streets waving Union Jacks. They're going to be waving the Australian flag because it's important to note that the King is just as much the King of Australia as he is the King of England.
But Australia's Republic movement says the country needs to move on. It's released a tongue-in-cheek video called the Farewell Oz Tour, encouraging people to think about a future without the royals. Nathan Hansford is the organisation's co-chair.
We've been independent for a long time now, but that last little step of independence for us is splitting away from the monarchy. Having an Australian, somebody who lives here, somebody who represents us, someone who is able to go and attend events not every 10 years, but every week.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has long made it clear that Australia's future should be one without a monarchy. This visit comes just a few months after Albanese's government shelved plans to hold a vote on a republic. People here are facing a cost of living crisis, so there just isn't the appetite for what many would see as a distraction.
This campaign has been a heavy weight to carry.
And last year was a game-changer too. The government was defeated in another referendum when Australians overwhelmingly rejected a plan to give greater political rights to Indigenous people. For many First Nations people, voting on the monarchy just isn't a priority. Alira Davis co-chairs the Uluru Youth Dialogue.
We're not white Australia anymore, we're a brown Australia. We have a very multicultural, diverse backgrounds coming from all nations, and it'd be very interesting to see a brown head of state or a black head of state. But before we do that, we need to include our First Nations and acknowledge and recognise that.
And that was Alira Davis, co-chair of Uluru Youth Dialogue, ending that report out of Sydney by Katie Watson. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service in London with me, Tim Franks. And let's return to our main story this hour, the reports that Israel says it may have killed Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, the architect of the October the 7th attacks from last year that presaged the start of this war in Gaza. The BBC's Jerusalem Bureau is reporting that, according, as they put it, to sources familiar with the matter, there is currently a growing assessment that Sinwar is dead. Final confirmation is still needed. I've been speaking to Francesca Borri. She's an Italian journalist who has long specialised in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She's interviewed Sinwar. We don't have confirmation of his death yet, but she thinks that the signs are that Israel may well have succeeded in killing him.
I see from the pictures his watch. So, yes, he might be Sinwar.
Just to be clear, Francesca, you're talking about there are pictures circulating online. I mean, they are graphic. I should warn listeners who might be encouraged to go and have a look for themselves. But they are pictures of a corpse that apparently bears some resemblance to the what we know of the photographs of Sinwar, but you're saying that you picked out one particular detail.
Yes, his watch, because he was always wearing this watch, which is not a very common model among Palestinians. So that's the first thing when I saw the pictures, you know, that just, you know, he's not the first leader of Hamas who has been killed. He won't be the last, for sure. I mean, perhaps Hamas, will change name, you know, there will be a different organization with a different name, a different everything, but, you know, at the basis of everything, there is the occupation. And I remember Sinwar as a man who was absolutely determined to end the occupation and to end the siege of Gaza, not to end Israel. Now, it was 2018, things, you know, might have changed in the meantime. I've been in touch with most Hamas leaders after October 7th, but...
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
Not, of course, with him. And probably, you know, maybe he had in mind already to destroy Israel, you know, in three generations, not immediately. And so that was, you know, because in the interview, it was 2018, we spent lots of time together, and he offered basically a long-term ceasefire to Israel. So it was totally different from October 7.
He was a man who was viewed in Israel, I mean, in a sense, put to one side the hatred that was felt in Israel, particularly in the wake of October the 7th for Sinwar. But military intelligence officials who had dealt with him when he had been imprisoned in Israel, I mean, they described a man who was the hardest of the hard, but also, they said, had this sort of very, very long-term view of the conflict, and that it was going to be one that would almost inevitably involve a huge amount of suffering on both sides.
Yes. I mean, he was ready to everything. He was ready to everything. I have to say, like most Palestinians, especially after October 7th, so somehow he was an average man, you know? And that's also probably why, you know, the Israeli security forces, when he was in jail, didn't really, you know, because basically there was no special file on him, no special nothing. You know, he was an average prisoner. And the point is, he was really ready to everything. Because, you know, probably what most impressed me in the time spent together, you know, usually we think of Sinwar as, you know, a man who has been almost 30 years in jail and then in a different jail called Gaza. I mean, in this small place, you know, out of touch, not someone who has been traveling or, you know, unlike other leaders of Hamas. And so the idea is that, you know, this man has no basically view of the world, has no he was surrounded, his key advisors, he was surrounded by Hamas leaders who basically lived for a long time in Europe or in the United States. They studied there, they worked there, and then they came back to Gaza with the Oslo agreements, which means he always had the very, very clear idea, not only of his goal, you know, freedom and dignity, the idea of, I mean, a very clear view of the world around him. And he knew very well what life could be. I mean, the life we live every day in Europe, and, you know, out of Gaza. And he told me 100 times, you know, I don't want my children, the children of Gaza, to live like this anymore.
Francesca Borri, a journalist who has interviewed Yahya Sinwar. Yisrael Ziv is a former major general in the Israel Defense Forces and joins us now from Tel Aviv. Yisrael Ziv, thanks for your time. There has been no official confirmation in Israel, but I'm guessing you're still pretty well connected. Can you tell me what you are hearing?
It's a pretty much done deal. They just confirm it, you know, with a few elements, but most likely Sinwar is not anymore between us.
If that is the case, if it is confirmed, what do you think it means for the war in Gaza?
First, it's a big issue. It's, I would say, historical justice, because I would say that, you know, Sinwar was the one to start this massacre of October 7th. And it's not just, I believe, a justice for the Israeli people and, you know, for all those victims' family, but it's also for the Palestinian people, because he was the one to bring on them the result of the October 7 vicious attack. So I think the world should be much better now, or at least has a chance to be better without him.
But the biggest question now... Does it change the way in which Israel fights this war?
First of all, you know, it's very fresh, and we have to analyze what does that doing, you know, to the Hamas, whether they're going to try to continue fighting or willing to give up. But I think it is a good opening for maybe political solution in Gaza. But you know, first and foremost is the issue of the kidnapped, of the bringing back the hostages. And if it will open that window, I think Israel will be much more ready to go for a political solution over there.
Yeah, and I know that you have been critical of the way in which Israel has recently conducted its war in Gaza and the attempts to get those hostages back. I mean, I guess one reading of this, and of course we have to be cautious that we have not got confirmation that Sinwar is dead. But if he is dead, I mean, it's going to be even more difficult for anybody to negotiate with Hamas, because who do they negotiate with?
I think that at least at the beginning, they're going to be even tougher in terms of any negotiations, you know, because after getting such a blow. But maybe afterwards, after a few days or a week, somebody over there, which most probably be his brother, to take to be in charge, he might understand, you know, that now he's next, and they're going nowhere. The only way for them to get any solution for their own life is by negotiating with Israel for a deal, for hostages deal. So let's see what is going on. You know, we are still in it.
There have been questions raised inside Israel pretty much from October the 7th onwards as to whether the calculations that are ultimately made by Benjamin Netanyahu, which then are the orders that the army have to carry out, whether those calculations are basically skewed, twisted, in order to prolong his political survival. How far do you think that remains the case, if indeed you think that it has been the case?
I cannot ignore that political considerations came in. as long as you know, but this government is with such partners like Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu, extremist right figures that do believe that Israel has to go, you know, all the way to kind of a final victory, which they themselves don't know how to define. And they have their vision of maybe to resettle Gaza with the Gush Katif, with the settlement, and all kinds of those crazy ideas. It became part of the plan of Netanyahu. That's at least the way I see it. But on the other hand, things are moving, maybe even faster than he thought, and maybe now with the achievement of, you know, killing Sinwar, it may bring that goal that he was talking about. It's a question of perception, of course. But on the other hand, you know, it's very clear what is next after Sinwar. What do you want to do? Yeah. So maybe now he will be more open to move and to move from the military act into a political resolution.
Major General Ziv, can I just ask you? I mean, given that Sinwar has always wanted to see Israel discredited, if not destroyed, do you think that, whether he is now alive or dead, that he has damaged Israel in the long term, because Israel's standing internationally has taken such a hit by the way in which it has conducted the war in Gaza?
Politically, yes. Militarily or physically, absolutely not, because it came out that Israel is much stronger than he ever thought. Both he, Nasrallah, and Iran, and apparently Israel standing is quite strong. So yeah, politically I think that Israel started very well, but got into, I would say, a very low position internationally. But in terms of security aspect, I think that Israel now is much stronger than, okay, definitely than the October 7th. Yeah.
Yisrael Ziv, thank you very much. And a reminder of our top story this hour. Israel says it may have killed Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, the architect of the October the 7th attacks of last year. Speaking to this programme, Dana Stroll, the former US Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defence for the Middle East, explained the significance if Sinwar's death is confirmed.
It would be a game changer. The Israel Defense Forces identified three top Hamas leaders in Gaza right after October 7th that they sought to eliminate. Two of those three, Mohammed Daif and Marwan Issa, they have already confirmed to have eliminated, and this would be number three. It's a significant decimation of Hamas's top leaders.
One other headline out of Gaza: an Israeli strike on a school building in the north of the territory has killed many Palestinians, including children. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC, and we'll be returning to our main story of the hour, the possible death of Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas leader, in just a moment. But we're going to touch briefly on the meeting of European Union leaders today in Brussels. One of the ideas which seems to be gaining increased interest among EU member states is how to deal with migration, and in particular offshore asylum processing centres. Marta Lorimer is a lecturer in politics at Cardiff University with a specialism in European politics. What does she make of the idea?
EU leaders have been trying to find new ways to deal with migration for years now. And as part of this, they are now trying to offshore EU migration policy. So instead of dealing with it and dealing with migrants coming into the EU, they will try and solve the problem by making sure that they don't even reach the European Union. So right now, Giorgia Meloni, the Prime Minister of Italy, has struck a deal with Albania. And migrants that are trying to come into Italy and that are rescued by Italian ships will, instead of being brought to Italy, will be taken directly to Romania, to Albania.
But just on that, Marta, I mean, Albania has, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but they've already said that they've no interest in replicating that deal with Italy with other countries. So presumably, I mean, even if it's deemed to be something that is worth doing, it's going to be difficult to select these countries, isn't it?
It is probably not going to be Albania dealing with everyone's migrants. And in fact, the idea is to start looking to other countries in the Western Balkans, because these are all EU candidate countries who therefore have a very strong interest in building good relationships with the European Union. And the European Union at the same time can say, look, these are candidate countries, so they are expected to apply the same standards for things like human rights that an EU country would. So they can shield themselves a little bit from critiques that, for example, they are not respecting international law or that they are sending migrants to dangerous countries.
And is there any evidence yet as to whether, I mean, it was one of the big arguments about the UK's now abandoned scheme to process asylum seekers who arrived in irregular or illegal ways to Rwanda. Is there any evidence that it is a deterrent, or it would be a deterrent?
There is no particular evidence that this is going to actually function as a deterrent, because if migrants are desperate enough to try and cross the Mediterranean Sea in boats that are frankly unsafe, then it is not particularly clear that they are going to be deterred by the fact that they might just not get there. So one of the critiques that has been moved against the Italian government is, in fact, that this is going to be a very costly plan that will, at best, achieve absolutely nothing and, at worst, just worsen the conditions for asylum seekers.
But just very briefly, I mean, I guess the background to all this is a fear among some EU leaders that this is red meat to those on the far right.
Exactly. A lot of EU leaders are trying to get even tougher on migration because they are worried about competition from the far right. Of course, in the Italian case specifically, this is a far-right leader that is pushing forward this measure, and other EU countries are looking at it with great interest. So that probably says something about how much far-right policies have been normalized across the European Union in the last few years.
Marta Lorimer, lecturer in politics at Cardiff University. Let's head back to our major story this hour, the Israeli military saying that it may have killed the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in a military operation in Gaza. It said it's checking the identity of three people whom it has killed, whom the IDF described as terrorists. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner is here in the studio with me. Frank, as I've said throughout the programme, we do have to be cautious because there has been no official confirmation. However, it could be a very significant moment, couldn't it?
If it's confirmed, then it's seismic. Absolutely. This for Israel, and not just for Israel, but its friends, Jewish people around the world. This would, I think, in many ways be comparable to the 2011 killing of Osama bin Laden, and the way that that was for Americans. It was a form of closure. Of course, for all the hostage families in Israel, closure can only come when they get their loved ones back, dead or alive. But this is a hugely significant moment because this guy, Yahya Sinwar, he has been absolutely involved in the Hamas project right from the very beginning. He was first arrested 1982, so 42 years ago, and he was involved in the setting up of Hamas. He became friends with Yahya Yassin, Ahmed Yassin, and he spent 22 years in Israeli jails. He learned Hebrew, in many cases speaking it better than his own jailers. He became the kind of big daddy on the block. He was, although not huge in stature, he had an aura about him that people feared. He was, in some ways, a very cruel man. At one point, he ran something called the Majd, which was the kind of internal enforcement arm of Hamas. And he was reputed to have caught one informant and made that informant's brother bury him alive in concrete.
It would, if it were confirmed, certainly be something that the Israeli political and military leadership can boast about. I guess the question, though, is, I mean, apart from the fact that 101 hostages are still being held, two-thirds of whom are thought to be alive, the question is, how could it affect Israeli military strategy now?
Well, it wasn't officially one of their war aims, but their war aim was to dismantle Hamas's military machine, both politically and militarily, and basically remove it as a means of ruling and threatening them, and, of course, returning the hostages. Yahya Sinwar will... He is and has been seen by many Israelis as one of the two big stumbling blocks to a ceasefire deal in Gaza that would bring those hostages back. The other stumbling block being Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, who many hostage families consider was opposed to that. I mean, when I've done my stints in Jerusalem in the last year, each night we would drive past those terribly moving silent vigils of people holding up pictures of their loved ones, and angry demonstrations in some cases, particularly in Tel Aviv, against Benjamin Netanyahu, who is seen as an obstacle. But look, if it's confirmed that he's out of the way, this is an opportunity for Gazans to perhaps change the way they're ruled.
Frank Gardner, our security correspondent, thank you very much for joining us here in the NewsHour studio on the day that the Israeli military says that it is looking into whether it has indeed killed the leader of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that helps you manage your money internationally. With Wise, you have up to 40 currencies at your fingertips. You can receive money, pay bills, and send money across borders without hidden fees. You always get the real-time mid-market exchange rate. See exactly what you pay every time. Join millions of Wise customers worldwide. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news. With insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, The Documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.